Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Dr. Jay Barton. Jay has a PhD in mechanical engineering and is currently working as a researcher for the Veterans Administration, the United States Veterans Administration, at the School of Medicine for the state of Maryland. Jay Barton, With Respect. Today.
Fine, thank you. Good morning, John.
Well, I didn't say in my introduction what you do and what your specialty is, but I'm going to let people know that one of the things we're going to be talking about is the concept and the reality of people's balance. And I don't mean their psychological balance. I'm talking about their ability to walk, talk, run, sit, stand, and their ability to stay upright. And we'll talk about all the components of that, which is absolutely fascinating. And I know a number of my listeners have questions about how they balance themselves. So, but anyway, first of all, Jay, where are you from originally?
Well, I was born in San Francisco, California. My father was in the military. He was a career officer in the Air Force. And actually, I was born there while my father was out going on his way to Japan during the Korean War in 1951. He commanded an Air Force base in Japan in support of the Korean War. So he left my mother and my sister in San Francisco while my mother had me. And then when I was old enough to travel, we followed him to San Francisco. And then we came back into this country.
To San Francisco or to Japan?
We came back. We left San Francisco to go to Japan.
Oh, I see.
And then after
okay.
his tour was ended, we returned to the United States.
Well, I know something more about your family because in some distant or close relationship, we are cousins of some sort.
Yes.
I can't define what that is, but we are. And I know that your grandfather was also an Army officer, a general.
Yes.
Before the First World War, and later in the Second World War, General Joseph Barzinski, right?
Yes, that's right. My grandfather was—he actually was from your neck of the woods. He was born in that area. I think he was born in Chicago, but I think he was raised in Wisconsin. And he entered West Point, I think, at the turn of the 20th century. He was an officer junior officer in the First World War. He was in the Quartermaster Corps. And then he had a career in the Army. And he was actually retired when the Second World War came along, but he was recalled to service. My father followed in his footsteps. Dad graduated from West Point in the class of 1934. And my father decided to join the Army Air Corps. So this was just getting started at the time, and then, of course, World War II came along, and the Army Air Corps became quite a large branch of the Army and the military. And my dad commanded Air Force bases, or Army Air Corps bases, mostly in the United States at the time, and then later at the very end in the Pacific Theater in Japan. Afterwards, my dad, of course, returned to the United States. He was married. He had my sister first and then me second. And we stayed at a number of locations in the United States after my father returned from Japan. His last tour of duty was in Washington, D.C., And that's essentially where I was raised. My dad worked in the Pentagon at that point, and then later he retired. But I was raised here in the in Washington, went to high school here, and then I left and went away to the University of Texas for college. And something told me at the time that that engineering was the place for me. I seemed to had been developing an interest in mathematics, and that type of an activity. And so, I enrolled in engineering school, and later I graduated from Texas with a bachelor's degree and joined General Electric. And for the next 20 or so years, actually, I was an engineer, first an engineer and then a business manager in industry. I worked for General Electric for about 8 years in several of their divisions around the country. And then I went back to business school to get a degree in management. I went to MIT and got a degree in, as I say, basically an MBA with a concentration in finance. The one thing that stuck with me in that period was that I actually wasn't departing too far from my engineering studies. Finance is a very quantitative course of study, particularly as at MIT, and I was using basically the same mathematical methods with it that I was as an engineer. So actually, I was sort of right back at home again. And then when I came out, I got more into mid-level business management with a few corporations. But as it turned out, I was never that excited about business management as I thought I would be. And I think the reason was that I actually liked working with numbers and doing that type of mathematical analysis. So in the early 90s, I decided that to return to, I guess, my main preference in life, and I went to the University of California at Berkeley to get a degree in mechanical engineering. How I came from working on industrial machines like turbines and internal combustion engines and nuclear reactors to the human body was something that I couldn't predict. My basic concentration in engineering was something called automatic control, and that's the means by which we control machines. Consider an aircraft. A lot of what an aircraft does when it flies is under automatic control. So that's an area that I was interested in. Of course, you know, one of the things that the body does is it controls its movements. So I had always had in the back of my mind that, in a sense, the human brain was the ultimate controller, at least when it came to human movement. And by various steps, I became involved in the study of vision in my mechanical engineering studies at Berkeley. And I found that the human visual system operates very much like a machine operates or an electronic sensor operates, the way the signals are taken in by the eye and the way they're processed by the brain. And so that interest stuck with me. And I was able in steps to basically refine my interests from understanding how vision works to understanding how vision is used when we, in conjunction with moving our bodies and performing tasks, like reaching for a can of soup in the cupboard above you. And that in turn led to how that's used in the overall control of the body, which then led me to take an interest in human balance. So in early, in around 2010, I was able to hit upon a couple of neurologists at the Baltimore Veterans Administration, who were also connected with the University of Maryland Medical Center, who were studying things like balance, and in particular, what happens to our ability to move ourselves when we've had a stroke. They were neurologists who specialized in stroke. And that's where I began my study of human balance.
That's a long and fascinating background. What are you doing specifically now? And I say that you've had the great track leading one logical step after another to the point you're looking at balance. So what is balance? And I think we use the word and we say, oh, I know what it is. I'm balanced. I'm well balanced. And or that person has got a problem because they're not well balanced. But what is balance?
Well, the balance occurs everywhere. Think of a radio tower that's standing up in your hometown. That you can imagine a structure that's supported by four legs and it's sort of standing on the ground. And in the simplest matter, it's just standing there. Well, when that was designed, they had to make sure that the thing would stand upright and it wouldn't tip over in wind and things such like that. And so it's actually a very mechanical concept, and it is even separate from balance in humans. But as it turns out, the same principles apply. I'll try to keep this simple, but very briefly, I think we all have an intuitive concept of what a center of mass is. It's a point in a body in which all of your mass is concentrated, or it can be thought to be concentrated. And if you took that center of mass, in the case of a radio tower, it's somewhere maybe midway up the tower. If you took that mass and you projected it straight down to the ground, in order for balance to be achieved, that point of projection would have to lie within the perimeter of what we call the base of support. And you can imagine the base of support is a rectangle in this case that just encloses the 4 feet of that radio tower. If for some reason that point moves outside of that perimeter, the radio tower will tip over.
And how does that happen? For example, let me step back. You talk about a balance point or core. What is... It's not a point in my head. It's someplace in my body, and it depends on weight and my foot spread and all that sort of thing, doesn't it?
Yes, that's correct. Let's take the human body for instance. If you consider a man who's standing, just standing with his legs about maybe a foot apart, and his arms extended outward to either side, you can look at each of the parts of the body as a segment. So we have the hand, we have the forearm, we have the upper arm, we have the trunk, we have the head, we have the leg, which we can divide into a couple of pieces. We call those body segments. And each of those segments has within it, if you will, its own center of mass. That's the point at which all of the mass, all of the weight of the body can be thought to act. And it's somewhere sort of in the middle of that volume. If we took a weighted average of that, we would land with a point that it was the center of mass of the whole body, and standing in that position, that center of mass would be located approximately in the middle of our pelvis.
Okay.
So basically think of it as all of the mass above that point is approximately equivalent or equal to all of the mass below it, and all of the mass to the left side of it is equal to all of the mass to the right side of it.
Huh.
So it's the point at which the, as I said, the mass is centered, and it's the point at which the body will move. It will move through a trajectory that point traces if it were, you know, moving around in space. So that's the center of mass. And this is a sort of an engineering definition of mass. It's actually been carried over to human balance. So if we take the notion of that man that I've just described with his legs foot apart and his arms extended to either side, and we took one arm and we brought it back in against his side of his body, the center of mass would shift to the right because that other arm is still extended. And if he started leaning to the right along with that arm, the center of mass would move farther and farther to the right and would reach a point where it would be at the boundary of his base of support, which is a rectangle, if you will, that just encloses the surfaces of contact of the soles of his 2 feet. So that's how we define our base of support. So whatever you're doing, and let's just consider standing for right now and not walking. That'll make the conversation a little bit easier to understand. Whatever you're doing when you're standing, however you're leaning, however you're reaching, that projected center of mass has to stay within the limits of that base of support, or either you'll fall over or you'll have to step in order to compensate for that and keep yourself in balance. So this turns out to be... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. You're finished.
Well, as I'm describing this process, this turns out to be quite a rather complicated process that's carried out by the brain and by the body. The brain has to determine, basically, in some fashion, where that projected center of mass is. It has to also determine what the base of support is, where the base of support is. It has to compare the two, and it has to be sure that that point still lies within it. And as the point approaches the one boundary or another, the brain has to figure out what it needs to tell the body to do to make sure that you don't fall over. It'll cause the muscles to activate so that it keeps the center of mass, the projected center of mass, within the perimeter of that base of support. So that's what's actually going on when we stand and when we move around in the world and perform tasks, everyday tasks that we do. Consider, for instance, standing in the kitchen and reaching to your side and above to grab a can of soup out of a cupboard. All of these considerations are at play here in order for you to keep your balance.
We're going to take a break right now, Jay, and when we come back, we're going to talk about integrating other parts of our body into this balance situation, balance issue. This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, with Dr. Jay Barton, a PhD in mechanical engineering, and we're talking about the concept of how we balance ourselves, our bodies, and how this matches other things in our world, such as we gave an example of a tower, a TV tower, or a microwave tower. This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Dr. Jay Barton, currently as a researcher at the Veterans Administration and at the Medical College of the University of Maryland, talking about balance. This is John Smetanka. Now, Jay, when we broke, we talked about this, the moving the center of mass, which sounds very intimidating because it's a mechanical concept, mechanical engineering concept, but it's simply where the weight in your body is distributed, right?
Yes.
And we're just aiming to be able to stand and to function when we talk about balance. How do we deal with this center of mass? Now, we're going to get further into this because there are other parts of our body, correct me if I'm wrong, that assist in this concept of balance. But let's pick up where you left off. We know that moving your arms one way or the other, to pick up a can of soup out of a cabinet above you, all of these are basic, simple things that require not just a basic, simple step by your body, but actually it's a combination of things that you've learned, right?
Yes.
Tell us about it. Where we go from here?
Well, let's back up for a second. I've talked about the more mechanical aspects of balance, but let's look, for instance, at the human body itself overall. When we talk about balance and the way it's controlled, what's really going on is that It's really a multi-system process. The human body, as you know, is composed of muscles. It's composed of skeletons, skeletal bones. It's composed of things called neurons. And neurons are the basic cell that make up our brain, but they're not located just in the brain. There are actually neurons that are located throughout our body that communicate with neurons back in the brain. And when we talk about balance, what we're really saying is that it involves the control of this muscular or multi-segmental musculoskeletal system by networks of neurons. And these neurons sense the state of the body, the way in which the body is configured or posed in space, and the way it's leaning. These are sensory neurons that do this. I'll talk about those perhaps more in a second. And these sensory neurons communicate with other neurons in the brain, which interpret these signals to determine how the body is posed and to determine whether or not the balance of the body is being threatened. And if it is, these other neurons take this information and they determine what the muscles have to do in order to counteract this. And then those signals are sent to the muscles and the muscles contract and then we maintain our balance. This isn't a one-time thing. This is a continuous operation that's going on because, of course, as we're moving our bodies, we're continuously disturbing our balance in different ways, and the brain is monitoring this, and it's then sending other signals to the to the muscles in order to counteract this. But it even gets more interesting, because in the case of moving our bodies, these are volitional movements that we undertake to perform some task. So, for instance, picking up the can from the overhead counter, the brain knows that it's going to do this. The brain knows that it's going to reach, and it knows that it's going to disturb its balance when it does. So, in fact, what the brain is actually doing is it's predicting how it's going to disturb its balance, and it's sending compensating or compensatory signals to the muscles to neutralize that that threat even before it happens. So, for instance, if you were to be standing up and you immediately reached your arm forward, that's enough to disturb your balance. But experiments and tests have shown that muscles in the front of your legs actually activate a fraction of a second before you ever move your arm, and those muscles are activating to stiffen your body to counteract the disturbance that the body is about to impose by moving the arm. So what's going on then is that the brain is estimating the current and the future states of our body, and in terms of our balance, it's predicting these out-of-balance conditions in this particular case, and then it's activating the musculature to counter them. So if we think of the systems, I mentioned systems before, if we think of balance, it's controlled or as maintained by several systems within the body, then we can identify, at least at a very high level, what those systems are. So it's the bones, the muscles, it's the sensory neurons that I talked about, and then it's the neurons in the brain that process these signals, that determine muscle activations. It's then the system that sends those activations to the muscles, and then it's the muscles themselves that activate to those activations.
Now, to step off to the side for just a second, this is all dealing with how the human system, neurons, skeleton, muscles, are acting just with one limited part of our existence. But at the same time, the same neurons, the brain neurons, are also regulating other kinds of behavior necessary to keep the organism, us, in tip-top shape, such as thinking, such as feeding ourselves, such as having heartbeats and lungs and all of that sort of thing. All of this is going on at the same time as the brain and the neurons, the compensatory neurons, are helping us with balance.
That's right. We perform a myriad of functions in parallel, as we engineers talk about. So you may have heard this, the brain is a massively parallel computer.
Mm-hmm.
That's to say that various of these processes are happening in parallel with one another, not completely independently. There is some crossover, there is some crosstalk between various systems, some necessary crosstalk between various systems, and that can help us and it can hurt us. If you're very distracted and you're performing some task, the distraction, the conscious distraction that you experience may affect your performance in the task. There's some indication that people who are older and who are frail, their balance can actually be compromised by cognitive difficulties. Well, when we think of maintaining balance, that's all usually subconscious. You can certainly be conscious of it, but normally it's subconscious. And it's interesting that some cognitive or conscious deficit may actually affect this subconscious act of maintaining balance.
So, for example, if I'm working a math problem or I'm reading a book, I used to do this when I was a kid. I was so voracious as a reader that I would walk along on the street and I would read my book. And
yeah.
And so every so often you miss the fact that there is a curb that you're going to have to compensate for, or you're going to fall flat on your face. And my mother used to say, would you get your head out of that book and save your life? But that's sort of what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yes, at one level it is. Actually, the way I would say that's affecting balance in that specific sense is that you've robbed the balance system of one of its primary sensory inputs, which is the vision system, because you're reading.
Uh-huh.
However, if you were walking down the street reading your book, one way in which the cognitive aspect of reading might affect your balance is that you don't pick your feet up high enough as you're stepping. And if you didn't do that and there was a break in an uneven point in the sidewalk, you might hit your toe on that uneven point and trip because you were concentrating more on the reading. So that gets to walking, which I'm going to stay away from largely in this discussion. But when you walk, I'll say one thing about walking. One of the things when you walk is that you have to pick up your feet. And as the brain deteriorates, there's some suggestion that the signals going to the feet don't make it pick the feet up high enough as they once did, and you find yourself with a greater propensity to trip because of things like this.
There are other parts of the body, and I'm going to talk about one that just bugged the heck out of me. I had a cold, head cold, some years ago, and it was long-lasting and fairly intense, and as I was coming out of it, I had an attack of what is called benign positional vertigo.
Yes.
That is, something in my balance system got all out of whack. It happened to me 2 days, and then I haven't had it since then. This is many years ago. But the point is, I remember how disorienting towards my balance and my whole way of thinking was this short episode of vertigo. Where does that come in?
Well, that's another of the sensory modalities involved in balance called the vestibular system, and that's your inner ear. The vestibular system is composed of two subsystems, if we want to call it that. One is the otoliths, and the other is the canals, as they're called. And what these two systems do is one of them determines the position of the head with respect to vertical. So if your head is tilted, that sense of tilt is being given by the vestibular system. The other element of that the vestibular system senses is the rate of rotation of the head right to left. So if you're turning your head fast or turning it slow, it's the vestibular system that's telling you that it's turning your head. So when we talk about the brain assessing or discerning the state of the body, the pose of the body, as I said, there are four sensory modalities that are primarily involved in that. One is the vestibular system that we just talked about. The other is the visual system, and the visual system basically tells you how your head is tilted with respect to true vertical, if you want to call it that. The other is the proprioceptive system, and these are sensors, sensory neurons that are located in muscle spindles and in tendons, basically around your joints for purposes of balance. And they tell you the orientation of each body segment to each other body segment. So if you look at your arm and you raise your forearm with respect to your upper arm, you perform that flexing motion, the sensation that you have of where your forearm is with respect to your upper arm is being provided to your brain by these proprioceptive neurons that are located in the region of your elbow. So that's how the pose and the configuration of the body is determined by the brain. And the final and very important sensor are the pressure sensors located in the soles of your feet. So each of our feet, at the bottom of our feet, we have thousands of so-called pressure sensors. And if you're standing and you lean from one side to the other, those pressure sensors are telling your brain how your weight is distributed between your two feet. That's what tells you that you have more weight on one foot than you have on the other foot. So what the brain is doing when it determines or when it assesses balance, it's taking the inputs from each of these four modalities. And it's not a single input, remember. There are thousands of proprioceptors. There are thousands of sensory neurons in the soles of the feet. The visual system has a million actual photodetectors in each eye. And then the vestibular system is also a matter of many, many neurons, sensory neurons, coming together and sending signals to the brain. And all of these signals are being brought together. They're being combined with one another, not just in the brain, but actually as these signals travel to the brain, they're being processed in various ways. But the brain nonetheless receives many, many signals, and it makes sense out of them all. And it constructs a picture, if you will, of the human body standing in the world with respect to gravity, with respect to true vertical, and also how the body is configured. and it uses all of this information to tell us how we're balanced. If we think about that, now we can start thinking about what happens when balance goes wrong.
Okay, now that is the point at which we're going to have to take another break so we can come back and talk about not only what goes wrong, but how we begin in our lives to help organize this whole fantastically complex process. This is John Smetanka, run with respect with Dr. Jay Barton, who is a PhD in a mechanical engineering, working now with the Veterans Administration on issues of and around balance. As I say, this is John Smetanka, and we will be right back. Back on With Respect with Dr. Jay Barton, who is a PhD in mechanical engineering and works with the VA, the Veterans Administration in Maryland through the University of Maryland School of Medicine. And we're talking about this complex process that we take for granted, which is standing and walking. It's called balance. This is John Smetanka. Now, Jay, when we left, you started to say, well, certain things can go wrong, and then we have to examine what happened, where the breakdown was. But I want to start you, if I could, is I have two grandchildren. One is two, and the other is about 8 months old. Okay. I have watched them learn how to walk, to crawl, to run. And it doesn't just happen the minute they're born. It takes a period of time before the older could learn to stand, for example, who could learn to move one foot in conjunction with the others and keep standing as opposed to tumbling over. Tell me about, if you can, about that process of where the brain starts, the whole organism starts to find its feet, if you will, and find its balance.
Well, that's a good point. No, these are not innate capabilities that exist in the brain the instant that we're born. They're learned. This is all learned behavior, and they learn through experimentation. Remember, too, that the brain is growing. The mass of the brain actually increases, obviously, with the size of our body, and the brain is growing until we reach, our teens or our late teens, and it's developing. So we're acquiring new neurons. Those neurons, most importantly, not just new neurons, but those neurons are making connections. And I'm not a neuroscientist, so I can't describe this in detail. But what I do know is that neurons start connecting with one another as we're growing and as we're small children, and they begin to make connections. And those connections that serve a purpose are strengthened. And those connections that don't serve a purpose wither away and die. So this is the process by which the brain organizes itself to perform certain functions. Those functions are, we talk about balance and movement of the body. Those functions are also organizing the sensory systems that we talked about and interpreting what the sensory systems tell us. Most of what we take in through our sensory system and the way and our interpretations have to do with experience and expectations, interestingly enough. So if I look at a visual scene, if I look out there at a scene, I'm going to interpret it based on what I expect to see. So if I see something funny, I'm not going to interpret it as an alien spacecraft landing on the surface of the Earth and little green men running out, even though that might be what it appears to be at first glance. I'm going to interpret it based on what I've seen before and what I expect to see based in the scene that I'm in. So I will interpret it as being in a movie, watching a horror movie, and not taking it literally, for instance, because I know from experience, you know, where I am and what I expect to see. Mm-hmm. And that's the case with all of our sensory systems and our consciousness as well. So, as I say, a lot of this is learned behavior, and it's based on experience. So that would tell you that the richer a person's experience, the more perceptive they're going to be.
So that's the process when I watch my grandkids starting to walk, starting to work puzzles, starting to read books and to color in books, and I see all different kinds of motor adjustment. I see increasing ability to have fine, that is, small motor actions such as coloring a crayon book and then running. And as each of those stages, I'm watching a process from the outside, and inside that little kid's body, millions and millions of things are happening. All
yep.
different kinds of neurons and other parts of the components of this body are engaged in a massive learning project.
Yes, that's right. So it's not just in the brain, of course, it's in the muscles as well. We're learning how to use our arms. We learn how to use our muscles to control our arms. And that's also, you know, somewhat a case of trial and process. In the area of learning body movements, there are some interesting engineering problems that have come up with this case. And we believe that the way that's done is that the brain actually itself constructs models of the body. And it uses these models to understand how an appendage is going to work in advance of telling it to do something. It figures out from this model, you know, what input it has to give it in order for the arm, for instance, to do what we want it to do. And so these are then sets of neurons which apparently remember this sequence of actions, and they can be called back up when needed and put together with other motor packages to construct an entire movement. And again, it's a case of that which is used developed and that which is not used wastes away. If we develop a body movement that's just a one-off, just done one time, and then go on and do other things, the brain usually, you know, will ultimately forget that movement. But if we're doing something repetitively over and over again, like I do, picking up a cup of coffee to drink it, you've got to figure that the brain stores that away for easy access so that my ability to do that requires less and less conscious thought as time goes on. And that's another important aspect of learning human movements. The things that we do over and over again, we're able to do not only more quickly, but we're able to do with less conscious thought so that we can devote neural resources to other tasks as we're performing this task as well.
Now, you talked about watching horror movies or sci-fi movies. I bet you have also heard about or seen the movie Inside Out, in which it's a cartoon about the inner workings of the brain of a preteen child who's being forced to cope with the fact that her parents are moving from the place that she knew and was comfortable with and had friends in into some other place, and she rebelled against that. And all these the image, which is, I think, a great teaching sort of moment, is you see all the different parts of the human entity, emotions, thoughts, balance, everything, focusing on what was about to happen and what was the reaction to that. I don't know, did you see that movie?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you got to see it. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
If you have grandchildren, you're going to see a lot of it. But at any rate, this is all going on. All of this is going on while the kid is learning the rules of behavior, mm-hmm. is developing conscience, is developing ability to work with other organisms, to wit, other kids and
yes.
their parents and their grandparents. And this is the more we talk about this, the more, frankly, excited I am about all the complexities we've got inside of ourselves.
Yes. Yes, and everything you can figure that everything is affecting everything else. So as we each grow up with our own individual experiences, you would figure that our brains would be affected in its own unique way. And this is what makes us each unique as we emerge into adulthood.
Now, before our prior break, you were talking about what happens when things start to break down. And I think that for people who have perhaps reached my age, which was probably, I'd like to say 52, but it's a little bit more than that, they begin to look at things not working quite as they did when they were running track or playing football or doing anything that people when they're growing up enjoyed doing or had to do. But what's going on with this sort of lessening of our abilities to maintain balance?
Well, we physically we reach our peak, our physical peak, at about 26 years old.
Ouch.
And as I like to joke when I give seminars, it's all downhill from there. It is the case that we start to deteriorate in our late 20s, even though we're longer lived, and that deterioration probably is slower now because we're healthier, at least some of us are. In general, as a general population, we're healthier now at any particular age point than we were in the past. We're nonetheless deteriorating. And all of the systems that I talked about are deteriorating at the same time. So our brains are deteriorating, our sensory systems are deteriorating, our muscles, our skeleton, our bones, all of these are deteriorating. And, of course, some can deteriorate more slowly than others. But nonetheless, you have this gradual decrease in all of these systems. And in some people who are fortunate and who remain healthy, their balance is never significantly affected throughout their lives. They'll live to a ripe old age, and they'll pass away, and falls and balance will never have been an issue for them. But other people begin falling at surprisingly early ages, 50 years old, 55 years old, and they just fell. They don't know why, they just fell. And what we figure is that, as I say, these systems are deteriorating, and at some point, some combination of deterioration takes us to a tipping point where under a certain set of circumstances we fall when we otherwise would not have fallen. To just back up for a quick second, the statistics on falling are actually rather sobering and startling for those who haven't heard them. Two-thirds of all accidental injuries and death in people over 65 years old are the result of falls. That amounts to 2.8 million injuries and 27,000 deaths in 2014. In 2012, the Medicare costs alone for falls totaled $31 billion. The most sobering statistic of all is that half of older adults, 65 or older, who have been hospitalized as a result of a fall do not survive the coming year. And all of these statistics are projected to increase in the future because our population is getting older, but also because the incidences of falls and death with fall-related injuries and death within that population are increasing as well. And this is probably the result of the increasing number of morbidities that people acquire as they age, things like stroke and arthritis, sarcopenia, peripheral neuropathy, obesity and diabetes. All of these can affect our balance because they affect those parts of our bodies that that are engaged in falling. So, so getting back to actual falls. So, as an engineer look at this, I look at this like a machine. And interestingly, you can actually go a long way analyzing the human body as you would some other kind of a machine that's similar to the human body. I look at the individual systems, and I ask myself, what's this system operate like when it's operating normally, and how is balance affected when this thing begins to deteriorate? So consider the sensory pressures on the soles of your feet. How is balance affected when those sensory systems start failing to give the brain accurate information as to how the weight is distributed on the feet? What would that look like if a person was standing and doing some task? Could I look at that performance and see it as different than the performance of a normal healthy person who's undergoing the same task? And then can I work back and come to the conclusion that whenever I see a person doing that in my test, that's the result of a problem with the sensors at the bottom of his feet?
Now, you used a phrase, neuropathy, neuropathy of the extremities, I think is my way of repeating it. What is that?
Well, the neuropathy is actually a common condition, and it's a loss of sensation in some sensory system. Typically, it's a tactile sensation. So peripheral neuropathy primarily refers to a neuropathy in the legs, it's a numbing. You lose sensation in your legs. You lose the ability to, as I say, recognize pressure on the soles of your feet. Your proprioceptive neurons are in your knees and in your ankles, and you'll lose those sensations as well. And this, of course, is a very important signal to tell us where our legs are and how they're configured. Neuropathy can occur just as a result of aging, but it's especially brought on by diabetes. And as you know, diabetes is one of the current scourges of humans in aging. It's reached epidemic proportions. It's typically brought on itself by obesity, which is also something that is in epidemic proportions. But diabetes is especially bad because it starts limiting circulation, starting with the legs, and it not only affects our sensory organs, our sensory neurons, it affects our muscles as well and causes the muscles to deteriorate and to lose strength and to lose function.
Let me stop you there. We're going to have to take one more break, and we're going to come back and talk about some ways that we can help the system of our own system and also understand those of others and help them to avoid some of the problems that you've described. This is John Smetanka, run with respect, and we're talking to Dr. Jay Barton, who is a mechanical engineer, a PhD in mechanical engineering, now working for the Veterans Administration at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and is working with the question and the problem of balance. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Dr. Jay Barton, PhD in mechanical engineering with the Veterans Administration at the College of Medicine of the University of Maryland. And we're talking about the question of balance, which affects every single one of us from the youngest child to the person at the highest end of lifespan. This is John Smetanka. So, Jay, when we were talking about, just before the break, about places that and ways and reasons why that complex balance system that we've developed over our lives can begin to fail, are there any ways that we could or should be preparing ourselves to avoid the worst consequences? Is it completely out of our control, or can we do some things to help ourselves?
No, it's not out of our control. I think that a lot of the problems that we're having with falls and with balance these days have to do with the physical deterioration of the population in ways that could be prevented. I talked about obesity, which oftentimes leads to diabetes. That has to do, of course, with our diets and such like that. Right now, I think the universal antidote to balance problems is some form of exercise, just getting up and moving around. As we get older, we develop more sedentary lifestyles. This is probably the main issue with respect to balance. And as those lifestyles take effect, we become physically deconditioned. And so, therefore, our muscles become weaker. They become more fatty. We become more fat. and the systems begin to deteriorate just from that inactivity. So, you know, a lot can be done just, as I said, by getting up and moving around, and it doesn't have to be excruciating exercise. Walking, I think, is probably the one of the best and easiest ways to address balance issues in advance, because you're using, when you walk, you're using all of the systems that you need to use in order to maintain balance. And I go back to the Greek adage, that which is used developed, and that which is not used wastes away. So exercise is an important ingredient. And right now we don't have targeted therapies to, you know, I talked about the systems involved in balance. We don't necessarily have therapies to really target an individual system yet. But this general exercise certainly helps in many cases. That will reduce fall risk by about 30%, 30 to 40%, just the general exercise alone. There are other things that involve people do to counteract problems in balance. Surprisingly, Tai Chi is an interesting exercise because the poses that you take in Tai Chi are balance poses. So you're actually exercising your balance when you undertake Tai Chi. Weight training. We've all probably seen photographs of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the gym lifting weights with her trainer. Weightlifting is important because that increases bone density, which is important to keep our bones healthy and not from becoming brittle. You know, there's an old saying that it's not so much that people fall and break their hip, it's that they break their hip and fall. And this is an allusion to the fact that as people age, if their bone density reduces too much, the bones become brittle and they can break very easily and lead to falls. Weight training, and it doesn't have to be excruciating weight training, but just some light weight training will do a lot to alleviate that and prevent that from happening, as well as it exercises the muscles, and it allows the muscles to keep strong. And we don't need to be extremely strong to maintain balance. Actually, you have to have your muscles deteriorate quite a bit before they actually affect balance. So weight training, of course, not only keeps the muscles strong, but it keeps them able to respond quickly. It, you know, it keeps their speed of response fast. And when you think of balance and necessarily, you know, needing to respond quickly, obviously, to things that are going on, that would be important as well.
Go ahead.
What I might also add is one other thing. You know, in my mind, a lot of falls and preventing falls has to do with awareness. If you're aware that your balance isn't what it used to be, you can start, you know, without even thinking, taking precautions to gird yourself for that. So you don't reach to the very limits that you thought you could before. You stop and think about it for a second. Maybe you step first, or maybe you hold on to a surface with your other hand as you're reaching so that you anticipate that you might fall. And we actually, our brains can help us in this regard. What I might say is that our brains aren't as dumb as we think, in some respect. As we get older, and as our ability to maintain balance deteriorates, our brains are actually aware of that at some level. And that's actually something that clinicians have picked up. They actually call it fear of falling. And we don't have great measures for it in my engineer's mind, but we do have measures for it. And what these clinicians have found is that fear of falling actually affects over 50% of the population over 65 years old. And when people experience fear of falling, they actually act on it, probably without thinking, but they act on it in the wrong way. They typically restrict their movements and activities as a result of fear of falling, which you would think is a logical thing and a right thing. But what that does is cause people to lead more sedentary lives, reduces their physical conditioning, and then actually increases their risk of falling and their fear of falling. And this then leads to all kinds of quality of life issues, because then people are more socially withdrawn, they become depressed, and it leads to a downward cycle. So fear of falling is clearly something that you can use to your advantage. First, you can use it to guard yourself when you're moving around in the world, but you can also use it to move around in the world as an antidote to deconditioning.
Again, we are dealing with a system which is amazing. You're describing a system which, even as the brain and the body age, there's compensation going on, that the brain continues to want to help the body maintain its integrity. And the methods of doing it are different than they might have been when somebody was 20 years old or 30 years old, as when someone is 70 or 80 or 90. Am I correct?
Yes, that's right. In fact, in engineering circles, I describe to engineers that the balance system is an adaptive feedback control system. And there's that word adaptive in there. So each of these systems compensates to the degree that it can for other systems that are failing. If you have a sore right leg, you'll compensate for that by taking more of the load onto your left leg. That's kind of obvious. But what the brain is also doing with these four sensory modalities that I spoke of is it's actually assessing their accuracy in giving it information, and it's downplaying or downgrading the contributions of those that it feels are less accurate, it judges to be less accurate than those of others. So these compensations are going on right within the balance control process itself at a very subliminal level.
And so we're coming almost to the end of our program, but I want to, you talked about ways of compensating, whether in technical terms, what the brain does, what the legs need to do, what, you know, walking and exercise. Can you give us, in layman's terms, what are the best ways of maintaining balance? You talked about exercise, but you also talk about diet. And what else can we do to keep ourselves from regressing into piles of protoplasm that sit and watch, you know, some stupid movie at night or whatever, and that's all they do? So where do we go?
Well, I mentioned diet as a result of forestalling obesity, and as we know, so a lot of it is that we have to live more thoughtfully. Because, for instance, in the case of diet, we have to think about what it is we're buying to eat, and stay away from junk food, because that just puts fat into the system. There are, you know, we've talked about the Mediterranean diet. There is some indication that some of those elements like fatty or fish and nuts are good brain food. They call them because of the omega-3 acids and the various elements in nuts. That also is good for keeping our weight within manageable levels. I think a lot of it is, you know, all of the things that we hear about, maintaining a good weight and maintaining exercise and doing things to keep our mind active. And an important thing is social interaction. You might not think about it, but social interaction exercises the brain. And it also, of course, it elevates our emotions. We tend to be in a more happy state of mind when we're among people that we like and that like us and that make us feel good about ourselves. That tends to put us in a happy frame of mind, improve our emotions, and at least indirectly, this, of course, is a reason for us to want to get up off of our chairs and get out in the world and engage with the world and interact with the world.
So when I go off to have breakfast with the boys and the girls and whatnot at my local breakfast nook, and I sit around and I talk to the same people and we exchange stories and life and comments on the world, that's actually helping my brain.
I believe that it is. The brain, as we said, is multifaceted. And so helping one area of the brain is going to spill over into other areas of the brain. As you know, I just completed 5 weeks of grand jury service, of which I was very unhappy and upset when I went into it. But I have to say that over the course of the 5 weeks, I started looking forward to going because of the interactions that I had with the other people there. And an interesting thing about it is that, you know, I would give my opinions and other people took them seriously. And that sort of validation, I realize, that sort of validation does a lot to elevate one's mood and one's spirit.
Well, Dr. Jay Barton, cousin, I want to thank you very much for your time and a lot of fascinating data that I got out of this, and also an impetus to get out of my chair and stop watching the soaps and get out and do something. So thank you very much. We've been talking to Dr. Jay Barton, a mechanical engineer, Ph.D., working at the Veterans Administration at the College of Medicine at University of Maryland. The name of our program is With Respect. And, yeah, thanks very much for joining us, Jay.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
The name of our program is With Respect, and we're on every Sunday, Saturday, and Thursday. Until the next time, remember, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.